Chapter 11. Occultation. A view common to nearly all commentators on the book of Job is that, one way or another, the Lord has reduced Job to virtual silence. Unnoticed is the fact that from the end of the book of Job to the end of the Tanakh, God never speaks again. His speech from the whirlwind is, in effect, his last will and testament. Job has reduced the Lord to silence. The books of Chronicles will repeat speeches the Lord made earlier, usually quoting them verbatim from the books of Samuel and Kings. Miraculous feats and escapes will be attributed to him in Daniel, where, remote and silent, he will be seen for the last time, seated on a throne, and referred to as the Ancient of Days. Though not so much as mentioned in Song of Songs and Esther, he will be frequently enough referred to in Lamentations and Ecclesiastes, and even fervently prayed to in Nehemiah. But he will never speak again. In the last chapter of Job, the Lord, without telling Job that he intends to end his agony, says to Eliphaz, "I am incensed at you and your two friends, for you have not spoken the truth about me as did my servant Job." And then, amazingly, the Lord requires that Job pray for his three friends, for, as the Lord continues to Eliphaz, "To him I will show favor, and therefore not treat you vilely." Job complies, and the friends who so relentlessly accused him of wrongdoing are spared. Only then does the Lord restore Job's health and fortune. Can we imagine how Job's prayer would have gone, or how he would have conducted himself in that pregnant moment, after the prayer and before his fortunes were restored? And what, after restoring his fortunes, might the Lord have said to him? Would he have told Job about the wager? Is all well that ends well? Even released from pain, how would Job have felt about the pain earlier inflicted on him? The book of Job has 42 chapters. Robert Frost's A Mask of Reason, in which the Lord and Job have a ruminative reunion, has as its last line, "Here endeth chapter 43 of Job." Frost gives unusually rich and reflective scope to an impulse to continue and complete the book of Job that many thousands have felt. The book of Job is an outstanding example of what John Keats called negative capability in a writer or a work. A poet of negative capability, Keats wrote, is one capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. Keats thought William Shakespeare the supreme example of negative capability for his unmatched ability to defer to his own characters. The characters in a Shakespeare play go their several ways, and the playwright has the negative capability to let them take his play with them as they go. He imposes upon it no more coherence than they will allow. The author of the book of Job lets Job and the Lord take the book of Job with them as they go. But what they make of it is, to a very considerable extent, what the Tanakh finally makes of itself. Job, as we have seen, remains himself to the very end, but so, despite all we have said, does the Lord. The Lord suspends his wager with Satan, lauds Job after Job's recalcitrance, and makes atonement to Job. But the Lord remains beyond predicting, and, despite everything the psalmist says, seems to hold himself above the law. The Lord may exalt the righteous and humble the wicked, but then again he may not. Nothing he says or does need imply more than, "I am who I am." The Job writer scarcely seems the aesthete that Keats was. His passions are moral rather than aesthetic. Yet such is the separate and contending beauty of Job's and God's speeches that each acquires a commanding power. Lift your eyes to the whirlwind and the sky, to the vision of all reality in which, in Stephen Mitchell's memorable phrase, death is a pin, and Job's complaints seem earthbound and trivial. Lower your eyes to Job's sores and the ash heap, and the Lord's boasts ring gruesomely hollow. In the way of great art, each voice for its moment is all-silencing. And the Job writer's negative capability is such that, particularly as we move past the book of Job into the rest of the Tanakh, it is all but impossible to say who has had the last word. If we infer from God's silence from the end of the book of Job through to the end of the Tanakh that Job has reduced God to silence, is that a victory for Job? Perhaps. But Job has always wanted God to speak after all. Particularly after his fortunes are restored, would he not continue in his wish? Certainly Israel does not want God to remain silent. Israel. The very name falls at this point with a certain strangeness on the ear. God's spouse and principal human antagonist has stood silent in the background for some time now, as her Lord contended with this Gentile. And yet the book of Job, for all its seeming isolation from the rest of the Tanakh, may be linked to it and to Israel, if it is read as what Jewish tradition would later know as Haggadic Midrash, legend in lieu of discursive commentary, on a strange passage in the book of Ezekiel. In Ezekiel 20, a group of elders of Israel comes to question the Lord, and, as in the book of Job, the Lord refuses to answer. Speaking to the man whom we earlier called the psychotic among the prophets, the Lord says, O mortal, speak to the elders of Israel and say to them, Thus said the Lord God, Have you come to inquire of me? As I live, I will not respond to your inquiry, declares the Lord God. Arraign them, O mortal, declare to them the abhorrent deeds of their fathers. In the ensuing indictment, the Lord accuses Israel of disobeying my laws and my rules, by the pursuit of which a man shall live. The phrase, by the pursuit of which a man shall live, is repeated later in the indictment, but then there comes a strange reversal. I swore to them in the wilderness that I would scatter them among the nations and disperse them through the lands because they did not obey my rules, but rejected my laws, profaned my Sabbaths, and looked with longing to the fetishes of their fathers. Moreover, I gave them laws that were not good and rules by which they could not live. When they set aside every first issue of the womb, I defiled them by their very gifts, that I might render them desolate, that they might know that I am the Lord. Laws that were not good? Rules by which they could not live? Is this how he demonstrates that I am the Lord? What the Lord alludes to in the phrases the first issue of the womb and I defiled them by their very gifts is child sacrifice. The practice of burning children alive as a propitiatory sacrifice to Moloch, though condemned at Leviticus 18:21 with specific reference to this Canaanite deity, was well known in ancient Israel. References to it in 2 Kings are frequent. It was one of the familiar forms by which apostasy from the received religion was expressed. Because the elders of Israel continue to engage in this abomination, the Lord now refuses to speak to them. If to this very day you defile yourselves in the presentation of your gifts by making your children pass through the fire to all your fetishes, shall I respond to your inquiry, O house of Israel? As I live, declares the Lord God, I will not respond to you. But if the historical mind is satisfied once Ezekiel 20 has been situated in the Yahwist polemic against Moloch worship, the philosophical or theological mind is not. Are the Israelites killing their children to appease Moloch, or, as the Lord's earlier words seem to indicate, to please the Lord? And if it is the Lord who requires this of them, is he God or the devil? This is, of course, just the possibility that Soren Kierkegaard took so seriously in discussing Genesis 22, where God calls for Abraham to sacrifice Isaac. The philosophical questions are undeniably interesting. If God occasionally becomes a demon, then on those occasions ethical mankind is his superior and must disobey him. If God is capable of testing mankind by masquerading as a demon, then paradoxically mankind can only please God and pass the test by defying God. For literary criticism, however, what counts most is neither the historical struggle between the Yahwists and the Molochists, nor the speculative problem of deceit by God, but simply God's character as such. In Ezekiel 20, the Lord characterizes himself alternately as benevolent and malevolent, a God of life and a God of death. If one is interested not in what he means, but in who he is, both sides of his character must be acknowledged. The Jerusalem Bible strains in a highly interpretive translation of Ezekiel 20, 25 through 26, to integrate the two. I even gave them laws that were not good, and observances by which they could never live, and I polluted them with their own offerings, making them sacrifice all their firstborn, which was to punish them, so that they would learn that I am Yahweh. In a note it adds, primitive theology ascribed customs and practices to Yahweh for which men themselves were responsible. Here Ezekiel seems to have in mind the commandment to offer the newly born, often so grossly misconstrued by the Israelites. But the text does not say that Ezekiel has this in mind. It says that the Lord himself has this in mind. Ezekiel is not characterizing the Lord is characterizing himself. If in the most ordinary, literary way, the Lord is allowed to be the Bible's protagonist, then the demonic strand in his character, though never finally dominant, can never be excised from it. The book of Ezekiel raises, though it does not develop, the possibility that the historical sufferings of Israel are the crime of God. The writer is willing to imagine, however fleetingly, that God seduced Israel into the very sins that he then punished, all to prove that I am Yahweh, which is to say, to reveal his character, to put himself on display. But to whom? The victim of his seduction, deceived Israel herself, cannot easily be the target of the demonstration. At least so long as the deception lasts, the Lord's action virtually requires another witness for whose benefit Israel may be demonstratively abused. It is this scandal or this conundrum that the book of Job may address, for Job is indeed a just man abused by his Creator for the sake of argument. As a literary character, Job has an abstract and impossible perfection, and his suffering, as a result, seems to stand outside history. Ezekiel and the suffering nation the Lord addresses through him stand squarely within history. The question on the far side of the book of Job is, how, if at all, will the Lord, as we now know him to be, as he now knows himself to be, return to action in the life of Israel? That question eventually receives its answer, but the answer does not come at all quickly. Sleeper. Do not wake or rouse love. Song of Songs. The Song of Songs, a cycle of poems about young lovers, might almost be compared to a Greek satyr play following the tragedy of Job. The book of Job, with its happy ending, is formally more comedy than tragedy. But the mood that lingers after it is dark and heavy with questions. It comes, therefore, as a surprise and a relief when something so sensual, so playful, so free from pain and even effort, as the Song of Songs rings through the air. The young lovers arrive on the scene almost as children, and force the adults to change the subject just as children will. Whatever Job and the Lord were arguing about is no concern of theirs. O give me of the kisses of your mouth, for your love is more delightful than wine. Your ointments yield a sweet fragrance. Your name is like finest oil. Therefore do maidens love you. Who are the boy and the girl, and the group of girls also so frequently spoken of? The cycle contains a poem for King Solomon's wedding, alludes to Solomon, and opens with the words, "The Song of Songs by Solomon." And yet the boy, most of the time, does not seem to be a prince, nor does the girl seem to be a princess. I am a rose of Sharon, a lily of the valleys. Like a lily among thorns, so is my darling among the maidens. Like an apple tree among trees of the forest, so is my beloved among the youths. I delight to sit in his shade, and his fruit is sweet to my mouth. These poems break the mood of the book of Job and establish their own mood more effectively by being about every man and every woman in love than ever they could by being about a king and queen. The Song of Songs never mentions God and never seems to allude in any other way to the religious traditions of Israel, or, for that matter, to religious traditions of any kind. For this reason, there were those who argued in antiquity that it did not belong in the Bible. They lost the argument to others who noted the mentions of the great Solomon, and further maintained that the poems were an allegory of the love between the Lord and Israel. Contemporary historical critics are all but unanimous in regarding the Song of Songs as secular love poetry, lyrics about human love and not an allegory for divine love. Yet when these poems are read as part of a reading of the Tanakh, they cannot fail to remind us of the only previous love lyrics in the collection, namely the ardent, if wounded, reconciliation scenes imagined in Isaiah and Hosea. The Lord has called you like a wife forsaken and grieved in spirit, like a wife of youth when she is cast off, says your God. For a brief moment I forsook you, but with great compassion I will gather you. In overflowing wrath for a moment I hid my face from you. But with everlasting love I will have compassion on you, says the Lord, your Redeemer. Therefore, behold, I will allure her, and bring her into the wilderness, and speak tenderly to her. And there I will give her her vineyards, and make the valley of Achor, pain, a door of hope. And there she shall answer as in the days of her youth, as at the time when she came out of the land of Egypt. Both Isaiah and Hosea compare Israel and the Lord not to young lovers, but to a grievously estranged older couple finding their way back to the love of their youth. This is a far cry from the love evoked in the Song of Songs. Yet nothing in all the poetry of the Tanakh comes closer to the Song of Songs than these lyrics of reconciliation do. A reader who has noted the emergence of tenderness in the character of the Lord, and then seen that quality forgotten or abandoned in the post-exilic prophets, as well as in Psalms, Proverbs, and Job, cannot fail to be reminded of it by the Song of Songs. Is an old couple not naturally reminded of love by a young couple? Hosea was ordered by the Lord to marry a prostitute, so that the children she would have would not be unmistakably his. She bore him 3 children, all of whom are given symbolic names, the third being Lo-Ami, not my people. For you are not my people, and I will not be your God. But in the imagined reconciliation scene, God accepts Lo-Ami as his child, as, quite probably, Hosea accepted the prostitute's child in real life. And I will say to Lo-Ami, you are my people, and he will respond, you are my God. If this scene were set to music, It would call for a composer like the Arnold Schoenberg of Transfigured Night, a composition that translates into music a poem by the minor German poet Richard Dämmel. In Dämmel's poem, a distraught woman confesses to her lover that she is pregnant by another man, and he responds, "The child you are to bear, let it cause your soul no care. Ah, look, the glistening universe, how clear! The brilliance of the whole is gathered here. You will traverse with me an icy sea, but warmed by a glow, our own, to me from you, to you from me, we will transform the stranger's child. Yours, but you will bear it now of me, for me. Ours for the splendor that you waken me, and for the child that you create in me." He embraces her strong loins, in the air their breathing joins. Two humans walk through high, bright night. The moment in Schoenberg's composition when these words are spoken, when power yields to tenderness and agitation to calm in a few bars of music, is one of the artistic high points of the 20th century. And such a transfiguring moment seemed to have been reached in 2 Isaiah and Hosea. In the post-exilic prophets, however, that moment seems to be forgotten. Or does something in Psalms, Proverbs, or Job substitute for it? By a strange via negativa, or mysticism by subtraction, the book of Job does become a book about love between Job and God. The word love does not occur in this book. But the devil, by luring the Lord into requiring gratuitous service from Job, by forcing Job to prove that he will indeed fear God for naught, strips down the relationship between God and a man to its pure form. Unless in some sense Job values God in and for himself, how can he say, when he has lost everything, and his own wife tells him to curse God and die, "You talk as any shameless woman might talk. Should we accept only good from God and not accept evil?" And unless God also values Job in and for himself, and not just as a trophy to show off to the devil, why may he not simply dispense with Job when the inconvenient harangues begin? We compared the Lord in 2 Isaiah to the grieving husband of an abused and abandoned wife. The Lord in the book of Job is more like the husband of a wife who, while protesting her devotion and his virtue, nonetheless recites a bill of particulars that any jury would regard as grounds for divorce. And by his reply to the voice from the whirlwind, Job does divorce the Lord. Forced to choose between justice and God, he chooses justice, a choice that the Lord eventually concedes was the correct one. The concluding reconciliation of the book of Job reverses the initial via negativa, the process of stripping away. Job is provided again with many extrinsic reasons to fear/love the Lord. But if in this strange way the book of Job can be read as a comedy, a love story with its own variety of happy ending, it is certainly not a love story with much tenderness or pleasure. It does not step into the dropped traces of Hosea and Isaiah, or summon their language or rich promise back into the mind. The Song of Songs does all that. Granting to modern exegetes that this is secular love poetry, it is nonetheless easy to imagine how an ancient editor might have wanted it to be more than that, and might have included it in default of any more genuinely religious love poetry. But if such is the hope, Song of Songs can only disappoint it. A cycle of secular love poems of some sort might be pressed into service as a way of expressing the Lord's love relationship with Israel allegorically. But this cycle is not of the right sort. On any possible reading of it, the relationship between God and Israel carries forward a great deal of pain on both sides. Love poetry can accommodate pain, but the Song of Songs has no need to. Pain may come some day to the young lovers who speak these poems, but it has not yet arrived. And the one and only verse that, by dint of being a bit cryptic and several times repeated, might seem to invite symbolic reading, is almost comically wrong for allegorical use. I adjure you, O maidens of Jerusalem, by gazelles or by hinds of the field, do not wake or rouse love until it please. The standard biblical image for Israel's fear that the Lord has deserted her, or, for whatever reason, will not support her, is the image of sleep. Rouse yourself, why do you sleep, O Lord? And conversely, the standard language for consolation and new beginnings, especially in 2 Isaiah, is, Awake, awake! Song of Songs is not written in conformity with those conventions, but cannot quite escape them either. A part of the charm of the book, to be sure, is that it is bathed not just in love, but in luxury and in the safety of, as it were, a great secret garden. And what greater, deeper security can there be than the security of protected, lovingly guarded sleep? But the glimpses we have had of the newly established Jewish community in Jerusalem have given us clear enough evidence of just the opposite. Want, incipient bitterness, and endlessly vigilant anxiety. If the maid is Zion and the youth is God, she cannot, just at this moment, want him to sleep on. Song of Songs, accordingly, is not and cannot be an allegory. At the same time, if God is now absent from the Tanakh, it is not because he has made any clear exit. No terms of retirement have been announced. He has not departed for heaven with a last blessing for Israel. If his speech from the whirlwind is de facto his last will and testament, we can only know this with certainty after more literary time passes. He did not indicate that it was a final speech when he gave it. His silence, even at this early point, begins to weigh on us. The charm of the verses can distract us from this background preoccupation, but the preoccupation also distracts us from the charm. Where is he? What has happened? Bystander. Returned to her people and her gods. Ruth. What follows the Song of Songs in the Jewish canon is another book about love and marriage, the Book of Ruth. This book, though it alludes piously enough to the Lord at several points, attributing both good and ill to his intervention, makes an oblique but shocking comment on how intensely, or otherwise, his presence is felt when, for the first and only time in the Tanakh, an honest Israelite innocently suggests the worship of a false god. The context, to be sure, is more than enough to make the suggestion primarily prudent and only secondarily blasphemous. Yet what is assumed rather than stated when the suggestion is made is still of great note, namely that there is no need to stop and ask whether the Lord will take offense at such advice. The matter is up to the human beings involved. The suggestion of foreign worship is made by the Israelite Naomi to her widowed Moabite daughter-in-law Ruth. Naomi is herself a widow, both of whose sons have recently died. Her family had been driven by famine in Israel to settle in Moab, where her sons both married Moabite women, Orpah and Ruth. The famine has now abated in Israel, and Naomi is preparing to return to her home in Bethlehem. She urges her daughters-in-law to stay behind and find husbands for themselves in Moab. Turn back, each of you, to her mother's house. Weeping, they insist that they will return to her country with her. But Naomi repeats her counsel, and at length Orpah agrees to stay behind. It is at this point that Naomi says to Ruth, "See, your sister-in-law has returned to her people and her gods. Go follow your sister-in-law." In context, the suggestion is not shocking. But that is only another way of stating that the context has drastically changed. The Book of Ruth is nominally set in the days when the chieftains, judges, ruled, an era of bloody warfare between Moab and Israel, when it would have been unthinkable for any Israelite to urge the worship of Chemosh, the Moabite god, on anyone already worshiping the Lord. But the action of Ruth is only nominally set in that remote era. By its placement in the canon, its literary time, Ruth comes much later, after the rise and fall of the monarchy, after the exile and the return. In effect, the Book of Ruth is about relations between Jews and Moabites after the reestablishment of a Jewish community in Jerusalem. The Moabites were non-Jews, possibly Hebrew-speaking, correctly understood by the Jews to be a closely related people. The author of the Book of Ruth implies, and implies approval of, mutually tolerant and even supportive relations between the two nations. But the Lord has never revoked his implacable opposition to just that sort of tolerance and mingling. Necessarily, then, the author of Ruth implies that the Lord is so inactive at this point that, at the very least, no reprisal need be feared from him when his wishes are disregarded. Having returned to Bethlehem with Ruth, Naomi instructs her daughter-in-law to attempt a kind of benign seduction of Boaz, a wealthy male relative of Naomi's late husband. On a night after the harvest is in and Boaz has been drinking in celebration, Ruth is to go secretly to the threshing floor, where he will be sleeping, and uncover his feet, a euphemism for his genitals. She does so, he awakens, and she asks him to spread your robe over your handmaid, meaning that he should take pity on her and marry her. The writer artfully slows the story at this point, but eventually Boaz and Ruth do marry, and among their descendants, we are told, is King David, for whose partially Moabite descent there is other evidence. The story is told with great affection and delicacy, and ends with the women of Bethlehem attributing its happy ending to the Lord, but with more than a nod to Ruth herself. And the women said to Naomi, after Ruth had borne a child by Boaz, "Blessed be the Lord, who has not withheld a redeemer from you today. May his name be perpetuated in Israel. He will renew your life and sustain your old age, for he is born of your daughter-in-law, who loves you and is better to you than seven sons." The Book of Ruth makes a piquant contrast with the Song of Songs. If the difficulties of marriage that the Song of Songs passes over in blithe silence include, among others, poverty, infertility, bereavement, and the in-laws, then Ruth can clearly enough be read as a book about the difficulties of marriage. But in this writer's hands, those difficulties are all met and overcome. Love among women, crossing generations and national lines, triumphs over all. The pure devotion in Ruth's statement to Naomi, "Do not urge me to leave you, to turn back and not follow you. For wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God my God," is justly famous and utterly convincing as delivered. Yet the Book of Ruth also has the same distinctly feminine brand of realism that we saw at points in Proverbs, a pungent shrewdness about men and what they can and cannot be relied on to do. As scarcely any other narrative in the Bible, this one is a tale of resourceful women and their relationships among themselves. Women have all the major roles and initiate all the major actions. Boaz, a supporting actor in the story, is a good man, but he needs to be helped to do the right thing. And Naomi, sending Ruth in the dark of night, knows just what kind of help will do the trick. What men mostly do in the Book of Ruth is die, leaving the women to cope for themselves. and the acclamation of Ruth as a daughter-in-law, better than seven sons, an echo of Elkanah's line to Hannah in 1 Samuel 1:8, is more than merely rhetorical. The shoe fits, and the women wear it with a certain flourish. As for the Lord, however, or rather for his traditional sensitivities, if the book of Ruth can be said to characterize them at all, it can only be to suggest a change in them. The change would be implicit in an allusion the book makes to the anonymous woman who was the mother of all the Moabites. In the destruction of Sodom, only Lot, his wife, and their two daughters were spared. With all the men of Sodom dead, there was no one left for Lot's daughters to marry. The two young women ply their father with wine, sleep with him, and thus the two daughters of Lot came to be with child by their father. The older one bore a son and named him Moab. He is the father of the Moabites of today. And the younger also bore a son, and she called him Ben-Ammi. He is the father of the Ammonites of today. Boaz is not Ruth's father, merely a relative of Ruth's father-in-law. She does not get him drunk. She simply goes to him after he has been drinking. And, taking the story as it is written, he does not sleep with her that night, after she bears his genitals, but only does so after their marriage. A marriage he contracts only after several proprieties have been duly attended to. But this honorable version of the seduction of Lot by the mother of all Moabites only serves the more effectively to turn a story celebrating the dignity, mutual devotion, and initiative of women in general into one rehabilitating Moabite women in particular. In discussing Proverbs, we noted that foreign women were almost inevitably the channel through which most of foreign culture came to Israel. It would have been so inevitably for other peoples as well, given a culture of war that treated the women of a defeated nation as property and exterminated the defeated men. Women were the carriers of culture across national lines simply because they survived to be such. Women would, of course, very often have adopted the culture into which they married. But how convincing could they ever be in that role? After the seduction of Lot, the other bit of Israelite history or legend featuring Moabite women was the infamous orgy involving the Baal of Peor, when Phinehas won the Lord's favor by impaling an Israelite man copulating with a Moabite priestess prostitute with a single thrust of his spear. This, in general, is the image of the Moabite woman: idolater, prostitute, debaucher of older men. The almost certainly female, and possibly Moabite author of the Book of Ruth, responds to all this by celebrating Ruth's chaste love for her mother-in-law, and fervent loyalty to Israel's Lord, and by suggesting, finally, that not all love between an older man and a younger woman is debauchery. But what does God think? Jews and Moabites, both subject to Persia after the fall of Babylon, would not have been in a position to exterminate each other, but would certainly have been able to intermarry. The author of the Book of Ruth is clearly not opposed to such intermarriage. However, the Lord, speaking through Malachi, the last of the prophets, made clear his disagreement with her view when he said, "Judah has broken faith. Abhorrent things have been done in Israel and in Jerusalem. For Judah has profaned what is holy to the Lord, what he desires, and espoused daughters of alien gods. May the Lord leave to him who does this no descendants dwelling in the tents of Jacob and presenting offerings to the Lord of hosts." In Ruth, the people of Bethlehem invoke the Lord against the Lord and compare the Moabite with the greatest names in Israelite womanhood when they say to Boaz on his wedding day, "May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, both of whom built up the house of Israel. Prosper in Ephrathah, and perpetuate your name in Bethlehem. and may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, through the offspring which the Lord will give you by this young woman. They allude publicly and boldly to another widowed non-Israelite woman, Tamar, who seduced her father-in-law Judah rather than remain childless. Conceivably, we could take as a new stage in the developing character of the Lord the implicit characterization of him here as a God who endorses intermarriage. What would make this a moment of characterological change for him, as well as, so to put it, of disciplinary change for Israel, is that it would return him to the universal benignity toward human fertility that his opening, "Be fertile and increase," bespoke. If that benignity has returned, then the Creator would seem to have won a round against the destroyer in his character. But such a reading would overuse a legitimate technique. A character can, to be sure, be characterized in his absence by others who interact with him. But the Book of Ruth lacks the copious characterization of the Lord that we find in Psalms or in the long, impassioned speeches of Job. Even in Proverbs, the text, for all its frequent secularity and remoteness from concerns special to Israel, has a clear and identifiably new role for the Lord to assume. The Book of Ruth, however, pays only very modest attention to the Lord God. It is far more concerned with a change in the dignity and mutual respect of women. The underlying polemic over the decency and orthodoxy of foreign wives translates with some difficulty into a statement that God Himself has grown more tolerant of them. Whether the Lord God is tolerant or intolerant, He is, with respect to the action of this story, almost otiose. In the cast of characters of the Book of Ruth, He is a bystander. Happy and unhappy outcomes are routinely attributed to Him. Good wishes are delivered with reference to Him. But the references, the pronouncements, seem purely pro forma. The Lord God says nothing, as already noted. And, for all practical purposes, He also does nothing. Recluse. You have screened yourself off with a cloud. Lamentations. Many, perhaps most, newspaper reporters have had the experience of attending a press conference at which the newsmaker, the president, shall we say, never arrives. The concentration and dissipation of energy before and after such a non-event are instructive to witness. At just what point does the great man begin to not arrive? At what point is his non-arrival fully accomplished? At the start, an observer senses gathered attention, a presence to the absence, an emotional and physical focus on the spotlit, camera-watched position the president will occupy. And then, the ungathering of that same energy, the mounting restlessness and slight physical disarray of the crowd, heads turning, someone half-rising or perhaps waving, then voices rising above the initial respectful murmur, and at length a trickle turning to a flood of departures as the absent presence becomes a present absence. A transitional mood of this sort affects the six books that follow the Book of Job in the Jewish canon. Song of Songs, Ruth, Lamentations, Ecclesiastes, Esther, and Daniel. Figuratively speaking, the Song of Songs is a pair of reporters who are in love with each other and oblivious to all the goings-on. Ruth is a wonderful story that one nicely dressed, rather dark-complexioned woman still in the seats is telling to another woman while keeping an idle eye on the door just in case the president comes after all. Ecclesiastes is an older columnist who fancies himself the dean of his profession and takes the occasion to hold forth a bit too loudly in a vein that he intends to be cynical, but that strikes many as merely confused. Esther is a slightly truculent print reporter who cares more about putting the television people in their place than about anything the president has ever said or will say. Daniel is a troubled young radical who is rumored to have had private contact with the president. All quite interesting. You could write a book about any one of these reporters. And yet, what about the president? And what about the people who still care about what the president might have to say? Who still think that what the president will or won't do is of immense importance? Imagine Lamentations as a somber-faced reporter in the front row, clipboard on his lap, voice-activated mini-recorder in his vest pocket, far more sad at the president's absence than irritated over it or inclined to hasten on to other matters. How can you all take this so lightly, he thinks to himself about his nonchalant colleagues. The country is falling apart. Lamentations is a mini-psalter, just 5 chapters long, consisting of laments over the destruction of Jerusalem. The challenging tone that occasionally is heard in the Book of Psalms, and that becomes a kind of war between God and a man in the Book of Job, is nowhere to be heard here. The author, whom we may call the elegist, pleads guilty on Israel's behalf. The Lord warned Israel repeatedly, he insists, that this would be the result of a national apostasy. The nation apostatized anyway. The Lord was as good as his word. The Lord has done what he purposed, has carried out the decree that he ordained long ago. He has torn down without pity. He has let the foe rejoice over you, has exalted the might of your enemies. Lamentations draws the imagery of the suffering servant of 2 Isaiah, together with complaint language redolent of Job. The opening line of Lamentations 3 recalls Isaiah's man of suffering, just as, a bit later, the reference to the wearing away of the writer's flesh and skin recalls Job. I am the man who has known affliction under the rod of his wrath. Me he drove on and on in unrelieved darkness. On none but me he brings down his hand again and again without cease. He has worn away my flesh and skin. He has shattered my bones. All around me he has built misery and hardship. He has made me dwell in darkness like those long dead. He has walled me in, and I cannot break out. He has weighed me down with chains. And when I cry and plead, he shuts out my prayer. He has walled in my ways with hewn blocks. He has made my paths a maze. But the middle verses of the same long poem, which proceeds in Hebrew alphabetic order, with a verse for each letter, offer a clear, if stern, explanation of what has happened and why. Even for the suffering individual, it is all part of the Lord's plan. It is good to wait patiently till rescue comes from the Lord. It is good for a man, when young, to bear a yoke. Let him sit alone and be patient, when he has laid it upon him. Let him put his mouth to the dust. There may yet be hope. Let him offer his cheek to the smiter. Let him be surfeited with mockery. For the Lord does not reject forever, but first afflicts, then pardons in his abundant kindness. Lamentations is remarkable for its juxtaposition of an excruciating sense of loss with an unflinching admission that the loss was merited, and with, finally, a desperately trusting plea for vindication against those who have inflicted the deserved punishment. Give them, O Lord, their deserts according to their deeds. Give them anguish of heart. Your curse be upon them. O pursue them in wrath and destroy them from under the heavens of the Lord. Though God made their sin his instrument, it is still sin. Psychologically, the elegist is still fully present to the Lord, still deeply engaged in the traditional problematic of Israel's sin and reconciliation, and still, through all the pain, refusing to despair of major divine intervention. There is integrity as well as pathos in this position. the writer refuses just to suffer. He insists on suffering as a Jew. What is happening is not merely happening. It is all part of an unseen transaction. To make it that, he must make it the result of his own and the nation's sins. Having done so, he can then believe that the Lord can and will end it, even though, as he puts it, "You have clothed yourself in anger and pursued us. You have slain without pity. You have screened yourself off with a cloud, that no prayer may pass through." Unfortunately, there is another kind of pathos for the reader coming to Lamentations at this point in the Tanakh. The Book of Lamentations, through the painfully vivid first-hand impression its descriptions convey, announces itself as spoken after the fall of Jerusalem and before the Restoration. At the time of its imagined writing, in other words, the elegist faces the full impact of the destruction of the city and the cruel onset of national captivity and oppression. But horrible as that time was, it was brightened by the hope of a great restoration. Now the restoration has taken place, and, sadly, much of what the elegists lamented continues, including, by the testimony of the post-exilic prophets, subservience, want, and a painful sense of loss. The reader knows, as the elegist seems not to know, that even after the restoration, Jerusalem could still say, "Slaves are ruling over us, with none to rescue us from them. We get our bread at the peril of our lives because of the heat of the wilderness. Our skin glows like an oven with the fever of famine." That knowledge forces the question of the Lord's silence back to the fore and would disrupt the new synthesis that seemed all but accomplished in the Book of Psalms, even if the Book of Job had not disrupted it in another way. In Psalms, language like the elegists about the sad state of the nation, though not absent, was rare. The Lord of the beauteous heavens and the wondrous law had become the intimate of the soul and the sturdy foundation of family welfare. The backdrop for the contemplation of Torah, wisdom, was increasingly the splendor of nature rather than the glory of Israelite history. And against that backdrop, personal and familial concerns seemed largely to have replaced the earlier hope for a true, massive national vindication. By implication, conditions of Jewish life on the near side of any such major change were bearable. To the elegist, however, they seem quite unbearable. And, whoever is right, the Lord continues silent. No further answer, no better answer, seems at all imminent. To return to our mundane comparison, in the room where the presidential news conference was to have taken place, they are now folding the chairs and taking down the bunting, almost afraid to disturb the last earnest reporter still in his seat, the one sitting so quiet and so straight, with his clipboard on his lap and his pencil at the ready, refusing to give up his hope, refusing to hear the silence. Puzzle. Who can straighten what he has twisted? Ecclesiastes. The word Ecclesiastes in Greek, translating koele in Hebrew, means something like assemblyman or assembler, and may refer either to assembled human beings or to sayings assembled into a book. Like the Book of Proverbs, the Book of Ecclesiastes contains both longer speeches and brief sayings. And like Proverbs, Ecclesiastes offers sayings on both sides of any number of issues. Folk wisdom is typically unsystematic and self-contradictory in this way. For every look before you leap, there is a hesitate and you are lost. Thus, at 3:19-21, Ecclesiastes says, "In respect of the fate of man and the fate of beast, they have one and the same fate. As the one dies, so dies the other, and both have the same life breath. Man has no superiority over beast, since both amount to nothing. Both go to the same place. Both came from dust, and both return to dust. Who knows if a man's life breath does rise upward, and if a beast's breath does sink down into the earth? But at 12:7, he says, concluding a melancholy poem on the ravages of old age, "And the dust returns to the ground as it was, and the life breath returns to God, who bestowed it." As for practical counsel concerning how life should be lived, Ecclesiastes is equally divided. The first preceding quotation comes to the practical conclusion, "I saw that there is nothing better for man than to enjoy his possessions, since that is his portion. For who can enable him to see what will happen afterward?" And yet, at another point, speaking of his attempt to enjoy his own possessions, he says, "Then my thoughts turned to all the fortune my hands had built up, to the wealth I had acquired and won. And oh, it was all futile and pursuit of wind. There was no real value under the sun. For what will the man be like who will succeed me, and who is to rule over what was built up long ago?" Ecclesiastes is more than a cracker-barrel philosopher, however. His inconsistency is not simply the inconsistency of folk wisdom, which is always ad hoc and in need of completion by the particular situation to which one of its offerings is applied. He is more accurately a proto-philosopher, a seeker after wisdom who has looked with skepticism on many of the ordinary pursuits of mankind, and has begun to look with skepticism on traditional wisdom itself, not excluding the special kind of wisdom that tries to cope with skepticism by a retreat to the would-be sub-philosophic business of just living a life. There is a quiet and appealing resignation in some of Ecclesiastes' speeches, but his judgment on his own speeches is that they are futile, and one believes that he is not feigning his rather frequently expressed loathing of life. As regards God, though Ecclesiastes may be described as here too, on both sides of every question, he has clearly begun challenging what might be called the hidden premises of Jewish monotheism. The notion of reward as in any way the consequence of human action, whether as covenant reward or simply as the reward of diligence, is seriously undercut by the quasi-Platonic notion of total divine foreknowledge of an endlessly recurring cycle of events. I realized, too, that whatever God has brought to pass will recur evermore. Nothing can be added to it, and nothing taken from it. And God has brought to pass that men revere him. What is occurring occurred long since, and what is to occur occurred long since. And God seeks the pursued. And indeed, I have observed under the sun, alongside justice there is wickedness, alongside righteousness there is wickedness. I mused, God will doom both righteous and wicked, for he has set a time for every experience and for every happening. If this has a fatalistic sound, it must be noted that fatalism has its consolations. At 9:7, Ecclesiastes writes, "Go, eat your bread in gladness, and drink your wine in joy, for your action was long ago approved by God." The King James Version translates, "Go thy way, eat thy bread with joy, and drink thy wine with a merry heart," catching the avuncular gentleness of the verse. If the non-recurrence of time is one presupposition of the Tanakh's belief in God, the interconnectedness of generations is another. Abundant offspring constitute a reward in the eyes of the Deuteronomist, and other rewards, as well as punishments, when visited upon the offspring, count for all the older writers as if visited upon the self. Ecclesiastes has a far more modern and individualistic, not to say somewhat jaundiced, view of these matters. You can't take it with you, and if you must leave it behind, what good does it do you? There is an evil I have observed under the sun, and a grave one it is for man. That God sometimes grants a man riches, property, and wealth, so that he does not want for anything his appetite may crave. But God does not permit him to enjoy it. Instead, a stranger will enjoy it. That is futility and a grievous ill. Even if a man should beget 100 children and live many years, no matter how many the days of his years may come to, if his gullet is not sated through his wealth, I say, the stillbirth, though it was not even accorded a burial, is more fortunate than he. In this connection, Ecclesiastes' vision makes a striking comparison with Job's, echoing Job's language at the start, but then veering off in his own distinctive direction. Another grave ill is this. He must depart just as he came. As he came out of his mother's womb, so must he depart at last, naked as he came. He can take nothing of his wealth to carry with him. So what is the good of his toiling for the wind? Job's naked came I ended with, "Blessed is the name of the Lord." The equivalent from Ecclesiastes does not. Ecclesiastes neither curses nor blesses God, but only finds him incomprehensible, and does his best to hedge all his bets, including any bet on wisdom or righteousness. Consider God's doing. Who can straighten what he has twisted? So in a time of good fortune, enjoy the good fortune, and in a time of misfortune, reflect. The one no less than the other was God's doing. Consequently, man may find no fault with him. In my own brief span of life, I have seen both these things. Sometimes a good man perishes in spite of his goodness, and sometimes a wicked one endures in spite of his wickedness. So don't overdo goodness, and don't act the wise man to excess, or you may be dumbfounded. Don't overdo wickedness, and don't be a fool, or you may die before your time. It is best that you grasp the one without letting go of the other, for one who fears God will do his duty by both. Here, too, Ecclesiastes makes an instructive comparison with Job, who said to his wife, "Should we accept only good from God and not accept evil?" But certainly went on to find fault with him. The scandalous notion that God is both friend and foe, creator and destroyer, is offered casually here, as little more than theological common sense, at least if we translate as the Jewish Publication Society does, following the medieval commentator Rashi. The Hebrew is opaque. The words translated, "Consequently, man may find no fault with him," are translated in the Jerusalem Bible so that we should take nothing for granted, and in the New Revised Standard Version, so that mortals may not find out anything that will come after them. Rashi's reading is simultaneously more pious and more daring than either of these more modern ones. Ecclesiastes' advice, "Be good but not too good, be clever but not too clever," is the ethical common sense that he derives from his theological common sense. Ecclesiastes, by the widest consensus among exegetes, is the ringer in the canon, the book that by rights shouldn't have got in. Even more than Job, it is a kind of inversion of all that has gone before. Yet a passage like this one is probably closer to what parents have been teaching their children, not excluding Jewish and Christian parents walking with their children to synagogue or church, for millennia. Ecclesiastes is the Polonius of the Bible. But what, if anything, does God have to say of this world-weary skepticism regarding his justice and his control over the course of events? Will the sky darken with another whirlwind, and that thunderous voice be heard again? Who is this who darkens counsel? speaking without knowledge. No, God lets Ecclesiastes pass in silence, just as Ecclesiastes generally lets God pass in silence. The most famous lines in Ecclesiastes are among the most famous in the entire Bible. In the King James Version, I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, neither yet bread to the wise, nor yet riches to men of understanding, nor yet favor to men of skill. But time and chance happeneth to them all. For man also knoweth not his time, as the fishes that are taken in an evil net, and as the birds that are caught in the snare. Even so are the sons of men snared in an evil time, when it falleth suddenly upon them. These lines present as thoroughly secular a world view as can be imagined. That the race is not to the swift is a kind of low-stakes, inframoral version of the Jewish complaint in Psalms, that the righteous suffer and the wicked are rewarded. What Ecclesiastes overturns with his somber eloquence is not the covenant between Israel and God, but the vision in Proverbs that effort, at least typically, brings reward. Go to the ant. And the verse immediately following, in which death is seen not as the common lot at the end of life, but as a sudden cruel entrapment in the midst of life, is again no attack on religious belief. Ecclesiastes, like the Job writer, has the common holding of Near Eastern wisdom rather than the particular traditions of Israel as his target. He differs noticeably from the Job writer, however, for he does not regard God as even a topic of overriding importance. And if God disagrees, he isn't saying so.